You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. Celeste Ng's new novel, Little Fires Everywhere, takes place in Shaker Heights, a progressive, upper-middle-class suburb of Cleveland. Longtime resident Elena Richardson rents her spare house at a discounted rate to a single mother and artist, Mia Warren, and her daughter, Pearl. But an outsider's perspective in a planned community can be destabilizing, and issues of class, race, motherhood, and conformity emerge. According to the Kirkus Review, this incandescent portrait of suburbia and family, creativity, and consumerism burns bright. The book is published by Penguin Press, and I'm so happy it brings Celeste to the show today. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your second, you said second radio interview? Ever?
My second live radio interview ever.
This could be so easy.
I'm trusting you.
So let's talk about Little Fires Everywhere. The book begins at the climax of the story, the conflagration of the Richardson house, and it moves backward to bring the reader to that point. What made you decide to start the story at the end with the explosion?
Well, I wanted the readers to know that this was a book in which something was going to happen, that there was going to be a conflict between these two families. And I wanted the reader to focus from the beginning not on is something going to happen, what's going to happen, but how did we get there? For me, that how question, the sort of human relation part, is always the most interesting part of the story. And that's always what pulls me into whatever story I'm writing.
So there's an explosion, but the title of the book is Little Fires Everywhere. So this explosion is what? The culmination of a lot of little fires? Am I being literal here, or is it figurative, or is it both?
It's both. I mean, the book begins, the first sentence, with a house that's on fire, that's burning to the ground. And you find out that the house was set on fire by the youngest child in that family, and she had set a lot of little fires everywhere, literally. But as you read the book, you start to get a sense of what kind of metaphorical fires were burning in this family for a long time, between them and the outsiders who come into town and sort of, to continue the metaphor, provide the spark that sets all of that stuff alight.
And so you know, Shaker Heights, as I said in the introduction, is an upper middle class community suburb of Cleveland. It's one of the first planned communities in the United States. So in a planned community, it's all conformity. A certain way of living, a certain way of doing things. Someone coming in from the outside, obviously that's destabilizing, but how are Mia and Pearl destabilizing to the world of Elena Richardson?
Well, Mia and Pearl are sort of itinerants. They move around a lot. Mia is an artist and a single mom. And whenever she gets the bug, she and her daughter pack up everything they own into their little Volkswagen and they drive to a new place. And so they're very different sort of emotionally than the Richardson family, who's been settled in Shaker Heights for a long time. Mrs. Richardson's grandparents had lived there, and then her parents lived there, and now she lives there. And so they're sort of grounded in this place, whereas Mia is sort of this free spirit who's floating from place to place. And Mia also, as we find out, has a lot of secrets, where she kind of takes a delight in breaking the rules and pushing the boundaries and doing things that other people maybe wouldn't do. And so these two families, when they come together, really just kind of can't see eye to eye. They really just sort of butt heads with each other.
So that makes me wonder, how then does Elena get to the point of saying, hey, Mia, Pearl, come rent at a discounted rate our house? Or is it one of those things where first impression is great, but then when you live with them, when you see them, that's when the problems occur?
Well, Mrs. Richardson, Elena, has a sort of progressive do-gooding kind of spirit. It's one of the great things about Shaker Heights, which is where I grew up, actually, that I love, that we're really kind of a community that is about trying to do the right thing, trying to help other people, trying to make the world better. And Mrs. Richardson rents out this two-family house, two apartments in the same building, to people that she feels sort of deserve it, that she wants to kind of do a good deed by renting out this house. So as you mentioned at the beginning, she gives them a discounted rate because otherwise they wouldn't be able to live in such a nice area and have their children go to such a nice school. And so she really sees this as a way of her almost sort of being a patron to Mia, to, you know, support her art and subsidize her rent in a way and, you know, allow this young teenage girl who hasn't had a settled home to get to be in one place. And that's part of what what leads her to bring this family into their lives.
So then what does Mrs. Richardson hope to get in return for her charitable exploits, for lack of a better word?
It's a good question. And I think the real answer is she wants to get sort of that sense of the kind of warm, fuzzy feeling that we often get when we've done something good and we've taken the high road and we feel good about ourselves. We feel like we've done the right thing. You know, it's sort of a self-pat on the back in some ways. That's a lot of, I think, what drives her, is feeling like she's doing the right thing.
So, as I mentioned, race and class play a role in this. And I can't remember, it's not Pearl that has, in school, she has a boyfriend.
It's Lexi, who's the oldest daughter of the Richardson family. Yeah, so the Richardson family is white, and Lexi's boyfriend is black. And the book takes place in the late 90s, I feel obliged to say, because one of the things that Lexi says is, oh, well, we don't really see race here. See, look, nobody cares that I'm, you know, a white girl and I'm dating somebody who's black. And that's,
I wish everyone could see the faces that we're making at each other, because whenever anyone says, oh, we don't see race here, it's like, oh, come on.
Yeah, and there's sort of, and I know what people mean to say when they say that. I think what they mean to say is that it doesn't make a difference to them. But the problem, of course, is that, you know, if you say you don't see race, you're missing a large portion of the person's experience, of their life, what shaped them. And I don't know anybody who really doesn't see race. You know, I don't think I've met anybody for whom that's true.
When you, so as you said, you grew up in Shaker Heights. When you encountered that yourself, or I'm assuming you have you encountered that? And what was your reaction when people say that to you?
I mean, in the 90s, which is when I was living in Shaker Heights, I feel like that was almost sort of the party line for everyone talking about race. That was the goal then, I almost feel like, was to be race blind. And I feel like it's only in the past decade that we've, you know, more people have started to say, you know what, that's actually a problematic stance. Being race blind means that you're willfully ignoring a lot of really important things in a lot of important context. And so I feel like in the 90s, for somebody to say that was sort of the height of 90s wokeness, I guess, if that's even a thing. And I think now when I encounter that, I try to push back a little bit gently, because I feel like that is meant as a sign of, like, you know what, like, I am thinking about these issues of race. And I try to say, you know what, I totally know what you mean, but at the same time, I think it's really important to acknowledge the backgrounds that different people have, and to talk about them rather than pretending that they don't exist.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Celeste Ng about her new novel, Little Fires Everywhere, set in Shaker Heights, Ohio. And this book is about race and class, but it's also a book about women and mothers. Why have this planned community, this Shaker Heights, the book set in Shaker Heights, why have it focused on wives and mothers?
Well, I think the issue of sort of motherhood and parenthood in general is something that I think about a lot, because I am the parent of a young child. And I'm in that place that I think a lot of people in my age sort of find themselves, where they have parents and they have children, and they now are reevaluating their relationship with their parents, because they're going through the same thing now. You know, there are a lot of things that I sort of wish I could apologize to my mother for, or say, I now understand why you didn't want me to do that, or you did want me to do this. I think thematically, though, the reason that that all started to come together and it made sense for this book was that Shaker Heights and communities like it, where the city sort of has an ethos and they really want to encourage people to, you know, do the right thing, as I said, and to, you know, make the world a better place. There's a little bit of a parental sort of role that the community actually takes on. Shaker Heights is, it's not sort of like a Stepford community in which you just have to, everybody's house has to look the same. It's such a difficult place to explain, because there's all this sort of planned diversity and planned sort of progressiveness. So none of the houses on the street were actually allowed to look exactly the same, because they didn't want it to look like a cookie cutter suburb. Likewise, they wanted to sort of plan for racial diversity, and so they would offer incentives for black families to move into mostly white neighborhoods and white families to move into mostly black neighborhoods. And it's such an odd way to tackle that problem, sort of legislatively. And that kind of attitude is almost sort of like the community being the parent who's like, you have to do this, and you're not going to do it by yourself, so I'm going to make you do that. And I think that that's part of why the mother-child theme that I already sort of was working with kind of clicked with the community.
So Mia is sort of shrouded in a little bit of mystery, and Mrs. Richardson decides she wants to look into it, look into Mia's past. Why does she feel so compelled to get all up in Mia's business?
That's exactly what I was going to say. She kind of gets up in Mia's business. And so that's one of the big questions of the book. So the incident that kind of pushes Mrs. Richardson over to get in Mia's business and really step over lines is that friends of the Richardson family decide to adopt an Asian-American baby, a Chinese-American baby, who's been abandoned at a fire station. They've been acting as her foster parents, and they haven't been able to have children, and they really want to adopt her. And it turns out that Mia knows the mother, the biological mother of this baby. That doesn't give too much away. And the mother wants to get the baby back. So this custody battle erupts, and Mrs. Richardson and Mia are on opposite sides of that battle. And Mrs. Richardson, I think in the ways of many human beings, but particularly I think people who want to be doing good, she tells herself she's doing all this for the sake of her friend. But of course, it's cutting a little close to home for her. She's got complicated feelings about parenting as well.
Mm-hmm. You intentionally set your novels in eras before cell phones and universal connectivity. And that sort of links back to Mrs. Richardson sort of diving in, trying to get into Mia's business, because back then there was no Facebook. We didn't have the tools then that we have now, that at a click of a mouse, we can find out anything we wanted to find out. Why do you set your novels in that time? Isn't it a more innocent time?
I wouldn't say innocent. I would almost say it was a more secretive time. That I think now it's very rare, I think, to find someone who doesn't have a social media presence. I mean, my mom is on Facebook, right? And people's grandparents that I know are on Facebook. And I think that in the 90s and in the 70s, as in my first novel, it was easier for people to kind of keep some things about themselves secret in a way that it's much harder to do now. You'd have to work a lot to try and hide where you used to live, if you used to go by a different name, if you looked different beforehand, whatever it was about your life. It's really easy to find that out now. And so I guess I think of the past as being maybe a little bit more of a mysterious time. There were more places to hide, and I needed the characters to have that.
Do you, in your real life, do you take steps to maintain a little bit of mystery, or let's just call privacy, because there really is no privacy anymore?
That's it. I mean, I carry a cell phone around with me, and so if someone wanted to and they knew how, they could just track where I was all the time. I try to, because I have a young kid, and because I'm a woman, and because I'm a person of color, and because I'm small, I'm short. I feel like there are safety concerns about that, as well as privacy concerns. And so I tweet a lot. I love Twitter. It's my sort of equivalent of the office water cooler. But I tweet about my kid, but I don't say what his name is, and I don't put pictures of him up. And I try, and I don't refer to my husband by name, and I try and keep a little bit of a barrier around them and my home life and, my extended family, because they didn't ask for that. I want to sort of guard them.
What's your next book? Are you planning a next book? I know this is your second one, and I don't mean to put pressure on you, but come on.
That's okay, because my son has already, I've been talking about going out on book tour, and he said, okay, so this is your second book. What's your third book going to be? And I said, well, I don't really know yet. And he suggested that I write a book about a mother and her son, and that I should name them after us. So that's his suggestion. I don't quite know yet. I've got sort of two ideas that are sort of very slowly kind of coalescing in my mind, and I'll have to see where they are. But right now, I get to be in the fun part where I get to just read whatever is interesting to me, and I get to go to museums, and I get to do all kinds of stuff and pretend that it's research, because you never know what's going to spark a new idea.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, in today for Leonard Lopate. I've been speaking with Celeste Ng about her new novel, her second novel before her third. It's called Little Fires Everywhere. Tonight at 7:30, Celeste will appear in conversation with Myra Jacob at Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn. For more information, visit our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. Celeste, thank you very much for joining us
today. Thank you so much for having me.